Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. For the first 25 minutes here, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It is Monday. Boy, it feels like a Monday to me. It's Monday all over, and it puts me in mind of what's coming tomorrow on Issues Etc., the beginning of a five-part series. Now, for those of you who enjoyed our summer series, our 10-part summer series on the historic liturgy with Pastor Will Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois, you will be elated. Tomorrow, we're going to begin a five-part series on the liturgy of holy baptism with Pastor Will Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel. Also tomorrow, the evening hymn, O Gladsome Light, O Grace. Pastor Henry Garricky of the Concordia Seminary Chorus will be our guest as we study that hymn. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It was Sunday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and because it's Sunday, of course, things that would normally be on the front page or on the back pages end up making it to the front page, especially this new television program called Joan of Arcadia. They have been pushing this thing like crazy. CBS has put this out. The premise of this, I have not seen this, so I'll be quite honest with you. The premise of the program is a teenage girl who has regular encounters with God. Now, God comes in many guises. He appears as a cute guy, sometimes as a cafeteria worker, sometimes as a construction worker, you name it. He gently guides Joan through her life. He wants Joan to fulfill her true nature. Now, I think that the cute guy manifestation of God in Joan of Arcadia is here to stay. Once they find a cute guy on one of these television programs, of course, this relationship will remain platonic, but once they find a cute guy, I think they will probably be using him over and over again. The premise of the show is a young woman who hears from God. Now, she doesn't get amazing instructions like, you know, go to college and become a brain surgeon. Simple things, get a job, do this, do that. The picture of God on television, Ken was talking about this a little bit before the break, towards the end of our conversation on Columbus Day. He was talking about a warning that he had issued to his congregation there in Moberly, Missouri. Not so much about the sex and violence on television, but about the way television makes you think, or the way television invites you to think, not only about the world around you, but about yourself, and apparently even about God. I'm always a little leery. No, I'll be more bold than that. I'm always very leery when pop culture, and especially television, takes up the subject of God, takes up theology. Now, I know they're not trying to do theology, but you cannot talk about God without doing theology. The very definition of the word theology is, in essence, talk about God. Words about God. So the minute you begin to talk about God, even if it's in a weekly drama series on CBS like Joan of Arcadia, you are engaging, intentionally or unintentionally, in theology. Now, of course, we cannot expect television to do justice to God. They never will. There have been some well-meaning attempts, I imagine. The big screen has attempted from time to time. I'll have to admit that, like many of you, my picture of God was, at least as a child, shaped to some degree by that Cecil B. DeMille movie, The Ten Commandments. You got Moses standing there at the burning bush, and you got this thundering voice coming out of the bush that doesn't burn up, and there's Moses in awe. Moses up on Mount Sinai and the same thundering voice coming out of the clouds and the thunder. The hand, and this was just unbelievable to me as a child, the finger of God that looks like, well, in retrospect, it kind of looked like a Roman candle, but coming down out of the clouds and writing on the stone tablets, the Ten Commandments. I think my theology was affected by those images. And to the degree that they were accurate and to the degree that they were faithful to God's self-revelation, Holy Scripture, well, that's fine and good. To the degree they were somewhat a distortion, well, it may have negatively affected my theology. Now, I don't think anyone is really going to take the theology of Joan of Arcadia that seriously, but there is a theology behind it, by the way. I don't know if you read this article, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on the front page, and then leaking over into the later pages, there's actually, from Barbara Hull, the creator of Joan of Arcadia, a set of ground rules that she issued to her writing staff for this program, ground rules that kind of create the premise and the world in which Joan of Arcadia exists, ground rules that she says are not intended to put God in a box, but trying to keep the story as open as it can possibly be, not saying what God can and can't do, but trying to direct the story so that no one view of God predominates. Here's a couple of the commandments for the writers of Joan of Arcadia. One, the God character cannot directly intervene. And this is pretty evident from the premise of the show. Joan kind of stumbles through life. God appears in various guises, giving her a nudge here and a nudge there, sometimes suggesting something, sometimes just speaking cryptically. And Joan is left to figure it out for herself. God does not directly intervene. Good and evil do exist. I guess that's good. God can never identify one religion as being right. And suddenly the ice gets very thin. Now you would think, or maybe you wouldn't think, I would think that if a God worth his salt appeared in this world, in this form, to a young teenage girl, perhaps first order of business, first question she might have is which religion is right, and that God would have an answer for that. But apparently, in the world of Joan of Arcadia, God does not have an answer for that. And if he does have that answer, he is unwilling to give it. The fourth commandment that rules the theological world of Joan of Arcadia is that the job of every human being is to fulfill his or her true nature. That really raises more questions than it answers, don't you think? What nature are they talking about? You know, this is a popular notion. I think this will play well with a lot of evangelicals. That God is really here just to help you kind of fulfill your purpose, your potential in life. To find your purpose and then fulfill it. It's amazing how quickly this notion has been picked up by Christians today. God is kind of here to help you find your purpose and fulfill it. To be all you can be. Or sometimes they couch it in more theological sounding lingo, like to be all he created you to be. But that depends on what nature we're talking about. If we're here to fulfill our nature, what nature is he talking about? When God says, well, I want you to fulfill your nature, I am certain that God doesn't want me to fulfill my sinful nature. I'm certain of that. Scripture is replete with accounts of God having to thwart man's attempt to fulfill his sinful nature. The flood is a case in point. Here's the fifth commandment. Everyone is allowed to say no to God, including Joan. I guess it wouldn't be much of a story. It wouldn't be much of a show if that weren't true. I mean, if God just showed up and said, Joan, go get a job. And she said, okay, whatever you say. Number six, God is not bound by time. This is a human concept. Fair enough. Fair enough. Number seven, God is not a person and does not possess a human personality. It strikes me that those are two different things. God could certainly be a person without possessing a human personality. A human personality is a trait of humanity. Just because someone doesn't possess a human personality doesn't mean that they're not a person. In fact, Scripture is very clear that God is not just one person, but three. One God, yet three divine persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And you know, I would argue that God possesses a personality. Most definitely in the person of Jesus Christ. Read the Gospels. This is not a person, Jesus, God in human flesh, with no personality. He's chock full of personality. In fact, his personality is so big, we can't even get our minds around it. I would argue that at least in some way, God the Father possesses a personality. There are definite traits by which he identifies himself. Number 8, God talks to everyone all the time in different ways. This list for the most part seems to play directly into the God we're comfortable with. Maybe that's the most instructive thing about watching carefully how pop culture depicts God, how television depicts God. Now, Joan of Arcadia, I think the creators of this program are trying to be even-handed. They're trying to say, okay, let's put a positive spin on this whole God thing. Let's show a God who is essentially there to help us, not get in the way, but to help us fulfill our purpose, and a God who is essentially there to, in every other respect, kind of keep out of our business. Good and evil exist, but this God isn't going to necessarily be telling us what to do or believe, and he's not going to be directly intervening. This is a very convenient, very comfortable God. This is a God we can keep at arm's length. This is a God who shows up to give us handy little hints and instructions when we need them, and when we don't need them, he keeps his mouth shut. Number 9, God's plan is what is good for us, not what is good for him. And I don't see any reason to make a distinction between those two things. Why would it be that what's good for us would not also be good for God? Scripture actually says that what God deems to be good is good for us, because God is, in the person of Christ, for us. And then number 10 is rather lengthy. God's purposes for talking to Joan, and again, these are the 10 rules that the Joan of Arcadia show, when the writers sit down and put together a script and plot lines, these are the rules they live by in the world of Joan of Arcadia. God's purpose for talking to Joan and to everyone is to get her and us to recognize the interconnectedness of all things. That is, you cannot hurt a person without hurting yourself. All of your actions have consequences. God can be found in the smallest actions. God expects us to learn and grow from all our experiences. However, the exact nature of God is a mystery, and the mystery can never be solved. So I don't think we can expect any character arc with the God character in Joan of Arcadia. Isn't it ironic that a show that's premise is God talks to young girl, helps her through the hills and valleys of life, that in that show, the God character is the most boring character of all? He is, in fact, really, according to this list of rules, the most limited character of all. Who he is really unimportant. He's simply a plot device. And you know what, folks? I hope that none of you get too deeply offended by this, but what the heck? I believe that this is very rapidly becoming the view of God that is being put forth in many Christian churches. God is just more or less a plot device in your life. Who he is not as important as who you are. You see, that's the premise of Joan of Arcadia. The real central character, of course, is not God, but little Joan. The real thing we're watching for and hoping for and all anxious about is whether or not Joan can fulfill her purpose in her life. God's purpose is more or less irrelevant to the story. There's a big book out, of course, called The Purpose-Driven Life. We've talked about it before. We'll talk about it again, by the way. We're scheduling a two-hour roundtable discussion on the book with Pastor Tom Baker and Dr. Larry Rast. And Well, I'll be there, I think, because I'm the moderator. Oh, and Pastor Will Wheaton. When I read through that book, I see a lot of similarities with Joan of Arcadia. An emphasis on my purpose, not on God's. A God that helps me here and there. His basic goal is to help me kind of be all I can be. And he'll be there at the end with the cash prizes if I pass the test. But between now and then, he'll step in when I need him. But, you know, when I don't need him, he'll stay out of my way. A God that is at a convenient distance, that we can hold off at a distance. A God that certainly expects us to learn and grow from all our experiences, but, you know, he didn't expect you to obey absolutely. Just do your best. Do your best. And this test at the end, it's not going to be pass or fail. It's, you know, there's a big curve. A big curve. So you really have nothing to fear from this God. Nothing whatsoever. He's not warm or fuzzy or, and for that matter, distant or cold. He's just there. He's a plot device in your life. Kind of keep the story moving forward. Yeah, he did send Jesus to die for you, yada, yada, yada. But what's really important now is not God's purpose, but yours. That's the real center of the story here. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Of course, the Post-Dispatch story highlights other faith-based shows, as they are now called. And, of course, that term faith is as broadly defined as it can be. It just goes to show, folks, if you want theology, oh, and I hope to God you do, because it's the only subject that really matters. If you want to know who God is, CBS probably won't be able to tell you. And for that matter, a lot of the best-selling books on Christian bookshelves won't either. They'll tell you all about who you are and your purpose, but not God's purpose. Now, Paul seems to indicate that God's purpose is the one that counts, is the one that matters, is the one that it's really all about. And it's not a mystery. Who God is in Holy Scripture is not a mystery. What his purpose is no mystery either. From beginning to end, from Genesis to Revelation, it's all about God's purpose. Paul actually puts it rather plainly. He says that God in Christ purposed to redeem us. It was God's purpose from before the foundation of the world to redeem us through the blood of his Son, Jesus Christ. And it's not as though that purpose of God kind of only goes so far and then it stops and our purpose takes over. No. It's all God's purpose. It's not as though God kind of, okay, here's my purpose. I've accomplished it with you. Now the rest is up to you. And oh, by the way, at the end, there will be a test. If you do your best, I'll have cash prizes. If you don't do your best, well, I don't quite know what I'll do with you. Maybe you'll get to sweep the streets of heaven while others ride around in their golden carriages, but, you know, you'll at least consider yourself lucky. No, the purpose of God doesn't end when God incorporates us into his purpose, when he incorporates us into the death and resurrection of his Son, Jesus Christ. It's not as though God's purpose then ends and ours picks up. God's purpose continues to hold sway. Not only to bring us to faith, but to keep us in the faith and to deliver us finally according to his purpose, toward a reward that has nothing to do with whether or not we figured out what we were doing here on this planet. Let me make that very clear. The reward that awaits you in heaven has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not you can figure out why you're here. I'll be quite honest with you, folks. On a day-to-day basis, I just don't care why I'm here. God has put enough in front of me, under my nose, to do, and he's made it clear enough what I ought to be doing. There's enough there to keep me busy the rest of my life, and I don't have to see the big picture. And I don't have to worry about the big picture. That's God's worry. And he's taking care of it. The reward that awaits me is not based upon whether or not I figured out why I'm here. The reward that awaits me is based upon the fact that Jesus knew why he was here. He was here for me. He took on human flesh for me. He lived a life of perfect obedience. If you ever want to talk about someone who fulfilled their purpose, you know, Jesus not only fulfilled his purpose. Here's the secret that will, if you actually believe it, will make it unnecessary for you ever to read another book called The Purpose-Driven Life. The secret is this. Jesus not only fulfilled his purpose, he fulfilled yours. His perfect life, his death, and his resurrection. And the reward that awaits us is only because of the life he lived, because he knew why he was here for us. He was here to bear our sin. He was here to serve us. He was here to live a life of perfect obedience, bearing that sin all the way to the cross. And at the end of a life that was lived in perfect obedience to what God had purposed for him, he laid it all down at the cross, the entire life down at the cross, a sinless life down at the cross as the sacrifice for you and for me. And there on that day where Christ hung dying on the cross and later that day lay dead in the tomb, there God fulfilled his purpose once and for all. That's what God had had in mind from eternity. It's what he'd been planning to do from eternity for you and for me. He raised Christ from the dead to say, purpose accomplished. And let me repeat it so that you don't forget it. And maybe you could just close the Purpose-Driven Life book now, unless you're just interested in passing time. Jesus not only fulfilled his purpose, he fulfilled yours too. And the reward that awaits you in heaven is not based upon whether you figured out why you're here, or fulfilled your destiny, or fulfilled your purpose. The reward that awaits you is based entirely upon the fact that Jesus knew why he was here for you and why he was on that cross for you. We'll be right back to talk with Dr. David Adams.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you know God's will for your daily life? Is God's will a mystery? Do we need to look for a sign from God to know what to do at any given moment? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article in the latest edition of the Issues Etc. Journal titled Locus and Focus, God's Will for Your Daily Life. The recent issue also contains a review of Armageddon, the latest in the Left Behind series, and Aaron Wolf details his spiritual journey to the Reformation from the legalism of evangelicalism. His article is titled A Beggar on the Wittenberg Trail. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive the next edition of the Issues Etc. Journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or write Issues Etc. Journal, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. This is Marriage Protection Week, and it looks like it's coming just in time. In addition to attacks from gay activists, Now the institution is bracing for an assault from a Senate Republican. It comes in the form of proposed legislation that will devalue marriage in the tax code. Keith Peters has the story.
The legislation by Oregon Senator Gordon Smith would change the tax code so that cohabiting couples would receive the same tax benefits currently given to married couples. Gary Bauer of American Values says that's wrong.
Not only are we facing a frontal assault on the institution of marriage by those who want to change the definition so that men can marry men, we're also facing an attack by subterfuge where various politicians are attempting to give all of the benefits of marriage to unusual couples and groupings without calling it marriage.
Bauer says both attacks are deeply threatening to the institution of marriage. Stephen Crampton of the American Family Association says it's just another part of the culture war.
What you have is a massive, well-orchestrated, concerted effort on perhaps the ultimate target in the war, and that is traditional marriage.
Gary Bauer says the word war is well chosen.
I think it does show us, if we needed any further proof, that we really are in a war over this issue, and we desperately have to wake up the American people as to what's going on.
Both Bauer and Crampton urge you to contact your senators, as well as the bill's author, Senator Smith, to let them know how you feel about this legislation. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
Gay activists and others rail against marriage, claiming those in the institution enjoy what they consider unfair benefits. But pro-family groups point out that strong and healthy marriages benefit the culture at large, unlike other arrangements. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Joni Harwell and me, Diane Summers. We'll find out about the Deutsch Country Days coming up on historic Luxenhaus Farm next weekend. And Jim and Edie Jorns joins us of the Children's Christian Concern Society about their mission conference coming up. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee, on AM 850 KFUO.
Issues Etc. and Concordia Publishing House are excited about our Book of the Month for October, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. Find out how God worked through this reformer to shape church and society. Lift High This Cross, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book at issuesetc.org and click the What's New section, issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. David Adams joins us for the remaining, for the next hour, from 4:30 to 5:30. We're going to be talking about several issues, beginning with Judge Roy Moore and his battle to keep a monument of the Ten Commandments in the Alabama Judicial Building. We'll get some of the history of that, we'll get where it stands now, and then we'll get to the issues. Should this monument of the Ten Commandments, as it is, should it be put up in a public place, in a place belonging to the public? We'll also be talking about two cases facing the U.S. Supreme Court. One has actually been accepted as for hearing by the Supreme Court, that one being the One Nation Under God case, which is, no, I'm sorry, that one has not been accepted. The first one that has been accepted is the case in which taxpayer dollars are being used to fund religious education. We'll talk about that one, and we'll also talk about the One Nation Under God case the Supreme Court is considering hearing. All of that during this hour of Issues, Etc. Our call-in numbers, if you'd like to join the conversation, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. David Adams is Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Before joining the faculty at Concordia Seminary, Dr. Adams served as the Executive Director for the Office of Government Information for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He is also co-author of an article in the latest issue of the Lutheran Witness magazine titled The Judge and the Ten Commandments. He joins us here in Studio A. Dr. Adams, welcome back.
Great to be with you again, Todd.
Let's jump right into the Roy Moore flap. First, do such monuments that have the Ten Commandments explicitly spelled out on them, do they belong in public spaces?
Well, if I just answered that question, we could just go on to the two Supreme Court cases, because that is the question that is being debated in Alabama and around the country. The question is whether representations of the Ten Commandments, because they are an explicitly Christian or Jewish and Christian religious tradition, do they belong in public property, or is there being in public property a violation of the First Amendment and its prohibition on establishing a state religion? That's the question that's being debated in Alabama and around the country.
All right. Let's see if we can just answer it in a brief way, and then we'll play out. What is your answer to that question? How do you think both the Constitution and sound Christian theology answers that question?
I think that there's no straightforward, simple answer that you can sort of apply in every case, because the representations of the Ten Commandments vary so widely. For example, let me, since we're talking about Judge Roy Moore, it's helpful to know that back in 1997, if memory serves me correctly, he first got into trouble with judicial authorities in the state of Alabama and the American Civil Liberties Union over this, because he put up a hand-carved wooden plaque, which he had carved himself, which had the Ten Commandments on it. He put that up in his courtroom. Now, there were many people who felt that since the law of the United States protects religious expression in the workplace, that Roy Moore was entitled to express his religious beliefs in his workplace, which was his courtroom, as long as they did not impose upon his judgment of cases, so that he was perfectly entitled to display the Ten Commandments there. And, you know, at the time, in 1997, I kind of agreed with that. I thought that that this was a legitimate expression of personal religious faith, which is allowed in the public arena in the United States. However, the situation has changed from 1997 to the present. What's being debated today is not a small wooden hand-carved plaque, you know, in Judge Moore's private workspace, but rather a 5,300-pound granite monument placed in the lobby of the state's Supreme Court building, the Judicial Center there in Alabama. And a number of conditions that would apply in the first case don't apply in this case. For example, it's difficult to regard a 5,300-pound monument as a personal expression of religious belief. Secondly, it's not in his own work area. It's in the lobby of a public building. And thirdly, even though he is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in Alabama, it was placed there on his own initiative in the middle of the night without permission from anyone, and his fellow justices have asked him to remove it as well. So there are a number of individual things which are different about this case than the 1997 case involving Roy Moore.
It should be pointed out that many of those fellow justices who asked Judge Roy Moore to remove the monument from the rotunda were and are supportive in principle of having the Ten Commandments as the basis for American law or other displays of them in a different venue.
That's correct. And so it's not the case that you can say quickly and easily that every public representation of the Ten Commandments is the same. You know, you have to look at the individual circumstances in which they're placed, and in some cases the motivation behind the people who are doing it. In Judge Moore's case, he has publicly stated on numerous occasions that his purpose for putting the Ten Commandments there is to reclaim America for God. Now, this is an avowedly religious purpose. You and I, as preachers of the gospel, are determined to preach the gospel so that God can reclaim the souls that have been lost. And now, it's appropriate for you and I to do that. It's even appropriate for us to do it in public. The question is whether it's appropriate for the Chief Justice of a state Supreme Court to make such an avowedly religious claim in the court building itself. Now, nothing prevents Judge Moore from preaching the gospel on Sunday in church, or even preaching the gospel on the streets in public if he chooses to do so.
Or, for that matter, witnessing to someone who happens to be passing through the rotunda.
Absolutely. The question is, in the conduct of his duties as the chief judicial officer of the state of Alabama, can he make such a claim on behalf of the state of Alabama? And I think most judicial authorities, and we'll talk about the theology of this as well, but most judicial authorities, just on the matter of the law, would say, no, the Constitution protects the personal expression of religious belief. It does not protect such an avowedly religious motive in the conduct of a civil office.
All right, then let's talk about the same question in terms of sound scriptural theology.
Okay. Here we have to, in part, answer the question of whether the Ten Commandments is merely moral law, or is there something else besides, I'm sorry, natural law. I said moral law. I meant to say natural law. Are the Ten Commandments merely natural law, or is there something of specific divine revelation there? And here we probably need to explore the difference between those two terms, natural law and revelation.
So what is natural law in its classic definition?
Okay, natural law is that knowledge of God and of his teachings that we can gain by observing the world around us, by using the senses and by reason. And so if we look at the Ten Commandments, we can see that some of the commandments, like honor your father and mother, do not commit adultery, and so forth, do not kill, and many of the others, are things about life that many people would conclude just by living life, by observing the world around them, by looking at their own lives and the way they react when people do things to them. They can see that the world is a better place if people do not commit adultery or do not kill one another. It doesn't require any special divine revelation in order to know that. The question arises with the first commandments, the first three commandments, which specifically call upon the people of God to worship Yahweh, the one true God. Now, those are not natural law. One cannot deduce from nature that one should set aside the Sabbath day and keep it holy. There's nothing in nature itself that would teach that. You only know it because the Bible teaches that God created the world in 7 days and that God commanded us to set aside the Sabbath day in order to sanctify it in memory of God's rest and in anticipation of the eternal rest to which he's called us in Christ. So there are parts of the Ten Commandments that are natural law, or could be called natural law, and there are parts of the Ten Commandments that are special revelation. And that's what makes this a touchy issue theologically.
So working back from the third commandment, as you cited it, remember the Sabbath day, you get to the prohibition against the misuse of God's name, which by very definition implies that there is a name by which a specific God is to be not only addressed, but also how he is to be regarded and called upon. Working back from that, you've got the specific God himself, have no other gods before me.
Right, and I know we're going to talk about the Pledge of Allegiance here in just a little bit. The Pledge of Allegiance says America is one nation under God. It would be different if the Pledge of Allegiance said the United States is one nation under Buddha or one nation under Jesus. That's the difference here. One is a much more specific religious claim than the other.
Or one nation under Yahweh, to employ God's Old Testament name.
That's correct. So one theological issue in evaluating the public display of the Ten Commandments is, are we promoting natural law? And that's usually the case that Judge Moore's followers make. They always say that the law of the United States is based on the Ten Commandments. What they mean is the law of the United States is based on Commandments 4 to 10, that portion of the commandments that are natural law, because one can demonstrate that quite specifically the law of the United States is not based on the first three commandments. There is, while it's our custom to take Sunday off, there is no law mandating it in the United States that no one can work on Sundays. There is no law mandating the worship of the one true God. There is no law in America mandating the prohibition against graven images or carved images. So it's quite easy to demonstrate that the law of the United States is not based on the first three commandments, but on commandments 4 through 10, if at all.
All right. At this point, someone would certainly object by saying, but, you know, the Supreme Court of the United States can hardly deny Judge Roy Moore his day in court and a favorable hearing because they themselves, in the very building in which they serve, they are surrounded by the Ten Commandments. There's the friezes outside in the south and the east face, I believe, of the Supreme Court building. There are a set of very large metal doors that, among other things, depict Moses with tablets. There is a frieze within the courtroom itself and in the door between the hallway and the actual chambers, there is a depiction of tablets there, too. How do you respond?
Well, I've been to the Supreme Court building many times. I've been outside it. I've been inside it. I've been in the court chamber to listen to oral arguments of the Supreme Court. And the claim is correct. There are images or representations of the Ten Commandments around the Supreme Court. There are actually two in the court chamber. If you're facing the, where the justices sit on the upper right-hand side, there's an image of Moses holding tablets of the Ten Commandments. And right above where the Chief Justice sits, way up at the center, way up in the top, there's a little image of two tablets that are not inscribed in any way.
Blank tablets.
They're blank tablets, but they're clearly intended to be the two tablets of the Ten Commandments. So there are Ten Commandment representations in and around the Supreme Court, but here's the difference. The Ten Commandments are not the only legal tradition graphically represented in the Supreme Court building and even in the Supreme Court chamber. You mentioned the frieze around the top. The frieze around the top has a great many secular and religious lawgivers, in addition to Moses and the Ten Commandments. So there are many other legal traditions represented there. And the claim that the Ten Commandments are the sole source of American law is simply not true historically, and it's certainly not true theologically, and it's certainly not true just in terms of the way that the law is represented within the Supreme Court chamber itself.
Let's take that up in just a minute. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Kurt is calling from his car. Kurt, thank you for being patient and waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Dr. Adams, my question is about natural law, and I've never understood why Lutherans are excited about natural law, because as Protestants, we believe that our minds are fallen and we cannot reason our way to God like some Catholics who would follow St. Thomas Aquinas. And it seems that the people who really love natural law and want to derive natural law are Roman Catholics who, in my mind, are just avoiding the scriptures. And that's why I really question how people can say that we derive law from watching monkeys and ducks and fish, and I don't understand that. When we see murder in nature, we see adultery, we see stealing. I guess as a Bible-believing Christian, understanding that my mind is fallen, I would prefer to go to a special revelation than I would try to concoct some sort of natural revelation. I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Kurt, thank you very much. Dr. Adams.
Thank you, Kurt. I'm not sure that Lutherans are particularly excited about natural law. We recognize that it exists. The Lutheran position on natural law would be somewhere between the Roman Catholic position and the position that you described, I think. We would recognize that one can, by looking at the world, see something about God and the way he works. St. Paul says so even in Romans chapter 1. He reminds us, you know, that the law there, by looking at nature, we can see something about God and his power at work and the way in which he created the world. We recognize that while the world is indeed fallen, that there is still some good which remains in it. I mean, we are naturally corrupted, but there is still beauty in the world. People can still behave decently toward one another in civil terms. They can't be righteous before God, but we can be honest in human terms and decent and faithful to a limited degree at least. And these things all point us in a way to God's intention in creating the world, and our imperfection in them in a sense, shows us our fallenness because it lets us see that we fall short of the perfect which God has created in the world. So do we derive law from observing the monkeys and fishes and so forth, as you said, Kurt? No, probably not. And I don't think Lutherans would suggest that we do either. But we do derive law from the world, from watching ourselves in the world and from seeing how we want people to treat us. And by observing that human societies are better places to live in simple human terms if they obey certain rules rather than other.
I'm thinking about Paul in the opening chapters of the book of Romans, who in talking about the Gentiles, who are without the law, and there he is speaking about special revelation law. He says they demonstrate by the way they act, in essence, he uses the term, that they are a law unto themselves. And it sounds as though kind of a bare bones, at least recognition of the existence of this concept we call natural law. Gentiles who are a law unto themselves.
That's correct. And so, for example, in Romans chapter 120, end of chapter 1, let me pick up with verse 18. It says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to him. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse." Well, what Paul's saying here in Romans chapter 1, verses 19 and 20 in particular, is that man can know something about God. It can know God's wrath. It can know certain of the commandments that, as St. Paul says, have been plainly visible to them, shown to them through what was created. What they can't know by observing nature is God's gracious, and they can't know the salvation that he has prepared through the Messiah and the coming and death of Jesus Christ and his resurrection. So the gospel can't be known by natural law. And not all of the law can be known by natural law either, but some of the law can. And so that's why here in America, unlike, say, ancient Babylon, if you think of the Hammurabi's law code, and by the way, Hammurabi's picture is up around the top of the Supreme Court frieze, too. And Hammurabi's law code in ancient Babylon begins with a picture at the top of the king, Hammurabi, receiving the law from the moon god, Ishtar, I think, if memory serves me correctly. Someone will call in and correct me if my memory's wrong. But, in the United States, we don't begin our legal code that way. We begin the Declaration of Independence with the statement, "We the people." We see that we the people are the basis of our national law, and we build our life together in the human community based on what we perceive by reason to be the common good of all men. And so many of us are guided not only by reason, but by the special revelation of God. And so we work hard to try to get laws passed that make the world a better place, because we know it will be a better place if it conforms to God's will for our lives, some of which may not be discernible by natural law, but much of it is.
Back to the representations of the Ten Commandments in the U.S. Supreme Court buildings, just so we can put that particular little quasi-myth to bed, are there any places among those representations where the Ten Commandments are reproduced word for word as they are in the monument that's in question with the case of Judge Roy Moore?
Well, I don't know that I've inspected every one of them in and around the Ten Commandments building, but my off-the-cuff answer is no. Certainly not in the Supreme Court chamber itself. There are some of them that have the numbers 1 to 10 on them. There are some, like the one above where the Chief Justice sits, which are just two blank tablets. I seem to recall that the one on the frieze does have some Hebrew writing on it, and you can actually see the first couple of letters, but it's really the first couple of the letters not.
The point that you made earlier about the fact that Moses is depicted as one of the lawgivers, along with the likes of Confucius, obviously a religious figure as
right.
well, Mohammed, Justinian, Charlemagne, King John, Hugo Grotius, Draco Solomon, another biblical figure.
Solon was, of course, the great Greek lawgiver in the past. Some of those that you mentioned were Christian, like Hugo Grotius. Others were not, like Solon, the Greek lawgiver. I mentioned Hammurabi earlier, and you got Confucius on that list. So there are a wide variety of sources cited within the Supreme Court building as sources for the American legal tradition.
Is that the essential message sent by these graphic depictions of the lawgivers in the Supreme Court setting? That being, we want to stand in the solid tradition of human law from its very origins, including Moses, including Hammurabi, including all these others.
Yes, except we should emphasize, just for honesty's sake, there are more representations of the Ten Commandments than any other around the Supreme Court building, and I'm sure it's true in the Capitol as well. So while the message is that we draw our legal tradition from many sources historically, the predominant one, at least in terms of iconic or graphic representation, is clearly the Ten Commandments.
Judge Roy Moore, you pointed out, appears to be confusing his duty as a civil official with his duty as a Christian. You were not interested in denying either of those duties, only that they remain distinct.
That's correct. And we can talk about this a little more as we go along before we move on to the court cases. But this is a very important point. Judge Moore often says, many times he said, that no one can make him deny Christ or make him deny God. Now, the problem with that is no one is asking him to deny God. See, he's equating removing the Ten Commandments monument from the building with denying Christ. And no one has suggested that he deny Christ or that he stop obeying the Ten Commandments. They're simply saying that his duty as a civil official is different from his duty as a Christian. As a Christian, he is obligated to obey God rather than men. But God doesn't command us to put the Ten Commandments in public buildings. God says that we can't deny him, but Moore isn't being asked to deny him.
Dr. David Adams is our guest. We're talking about Judge Roy Moore and the Ten Commandment monument issue, which continues to percolate in the news. We'll also be talking after the break about two cases facing the U.S. Supreme Court, one having to do with the Pledge of Allegiance, one nation under God, the other having to do with whether or not taxpayer dollars can be used to fund religious instruction in part or in whole. If you'd like to join the conversation, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our conversation continues for the next 25 minutes after this break.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.